Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack. I'm Chris. I'm Michael Prinz. Today I'll be reading from Kiplinger Personal Finance, the June edition. The first article today is written by Nellie S. Huang, titled 10 Great Active ETFs. Exchange-traded funds aren't just index trackers anymore. This is on page 28. Investors weren't ready for actively managed exchange-traded funds back in 2008, when the first one launched. That ETF, a short-term bond strategy called Bear Stearns Current Yield, closed before its first year anniversary as the financial crisis was unfolding, without having attracted much money. Times have changed. Active ETFs, through which managers target individual stocks instead of broader indexes, are pulling in billions these days. Over the past 12 months, through the end of March, actively managed ETFs have garnered $157 billion, or 22% of all net ETF inflows. That's the sum of money deposited minus money that's withdrawn. A decade ago, active ETF strategies claimed just 2% of all net inflows, says Aniket Ullal, head of ETF data and analytics for investment research firm CFRA Research, with the bulk of assets going into far more popular index tracking ETFs. The embrace of active ETFs is reflected in a surge of both demand and supply. Many advisors now prefer ETFs to mutual funds because ETFs tend to be more tax efficient. And advisors want access to ETFs that employ the same active mutual fund strategies they use in client portfolios. Mutual fund firms are now meeting those demands. After many years of ETFs pulling in more money than mutual funds, the big fund companies have had to enter the ETF space, says Ullal. That partly explains the accelerated pace of new active ETF launches. Of the 327 actively managed diversified stock ETFs in the U.S. today, almost half were launched over the past 2 years. We took a closer look at the offerings in U.S. diversified stock funds to find the best new active ETFs available today. The funds we highlight below are diversified. None are sector funds or so-called thematic funds that invest in a particular trend such as clean energy or artificial intelligence. All returns and data are through March 31st. First, we have Avantis U.S. Large Cap Value and Avantis U.S. Small Cap Value. The folks at Avantis have a specific definition of value. We want good prices, but also good profits. We target that intersection, says Phil McInnes, the firm's chief investment strategist. Profitability and a low price, he adds, are good proxies for expected return rates. So far, so good. Since its September 2021 launch, Avantis U.S. Large Cap Value has returned 12.5% annualized, outpacing the S&P 500 index and the lion's share of its ETF peers, funds that focus on bargain-price large company stocks. Top holdings in the Large Cap Value Fund, which charges a 0.15 expense ratio, include Meta Platforms, JPMorgan Chase, and Costco Wholesale. Despite the big run-up in Meta shares, the stock still ranks high on value and profitability. It doesn't get the highest ranking on those measures, but it's a big company that we factor in market cap to determine weight in the portfolio, says McInnes. Avantis U.S. Small Cap Value launched in September 2019 and has a longer track record that's equally bright. The Small Company Value Fund, which charges a 0.25% annual expense ratio, has returned 11% annualized over the past 3 years. That's better than 91% of its peers, just funds that focus on small, value-priced companies. It also beat the 0.1% annualized loss in the Russell 2000, an index of small company stocks. At last report, the top three stocks in the fund were wood products and materials maker Boyes Cascade, retailer Abercrombie & Fitch, and SM Energy. Next is Capital Group Core Equity, Capital Group Dividend Value, and Capital Group Growth. Capital Group is the firm behind the well-regarded American Funds suite of mutual funds, which have been sold mostly through advisors. With the 2022 launch of active ETFs, however, the firm's strategies are now available to any investor. Like the mutual funds, the ETFs are managed in the capital system way, in which multiple managers divide a fund's assets and run each sleeve independently. But the Capital Group ETFs are not clones of existing American fund products. Capital Group Core Equity aims for long-term growth of capital and income. The fund's six managers can invest in companies of any size, but the portfolio holds mostly large company stocks, a mix of fast growers and blue-chip dividend payers. Microsoft, Amazon.com, Broadcom, and General Electric are among the fund's top five holdings. The goal is to offer a smoother ride for investors, says Zahid Nakuda, an ETF specialist with Capital Group. Since its inception in February 2022, Core Equity has returned 13.3% annualized, better than the 11.8% average annualized gain in the S&P 500. Its expense ratio is 0.33%. Capital Group growth and Capital Group dividend value are often paired together in a portfolio, says Nakuda. Over the past 2 years, a 50-50 combination of the growth and dividend value ETFs has returned 12.2% annualized, beating the S&P 500 by an average of nearly 3 percentage points per year. The growth fund holds, not surprisingly, some of the market's best performers of late, including Meta Platforms and Netflix. But Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, Visa, and Intuitive Surgical are also among the top 10 holdings. Top holdings at dividend value include Microsoft, British American Tobacco, Carrier Global, and Broadcom. The growth ETF has a 0.39% expense ratio. Dividend value, 0.33%. Next is Fidelity Enhanced Large Cap Core. This fund is designed to serve as a core holding in a portfolio, much like an index fund. But it aims to beat its underlying benchmark, the S&P 500, with less risk by using a proprietary quantitative model. Over the past 3 and 5 years, Fidelity Enhanced Large Cap Core has beaten its benchmark on an annualized return basis with less volatility. The fund charges a 0.18% expense ratio. Computers drive the stock picking, employing machine learning and natural language processing, for instance. But it isn't a black box, says Mike Hagopian, a portfolio specialist who works closely with the firm's enhanced suite of funds. The model focuses on the usual fundamental stock measures, such as valuation, growth, and quality. But it also homes in on atypical measures, such as spending on research and development, intellectual property assets, and what current activity in the options market says about a particular company's shares. The aim is to find reasonably priced shares in a company with strong prospects, growing earnings, and a stock price with upward momentum, all relative to peers. There isn't a singular characteristic or factor that defines our favorites, says Hagopian, but we look at the overall picture. Putnam Focused Large Cap Value. Only 44 stocks fill this ETF's portfolio, and that's by design. We want to own the best stocks within each sector, says Lauren Damore, who co-manages the fund with Darren Jarock. They favor companies with strong cash flows and the ability to generate and increase dividends for investors. But Damore is quick to add that there isn't one soundbite or even a few bullet points that characterize stocks in their portfolio. The managers recently added to their stake in Citigroup. Shares in the financial services company typically trade at a discount relative to peers because historically it has underperformed. But Citi chief Jane Fraser is working to improve the company's profitability, in part by reducing expenses. That's what we're playing for, says Damore. The fund's secret sauce is the manager's maniacal attention to risk, says Damore. They take their time building the portfolio. We own stocks for an average of 5 years, and it takes us about an average of 6 months to become comfortable adding a new name to the fund, says Damore. Insurance giant American International Group, ExxonMobil, and investment firm Apollo Asset Management were top holdings at last report. The ETF opened in May 2021, though it's worth mentioning that the managers have been running the strategy as a separately managed account since 2016. Since the ETF launched, its 14.5% annualized return has beaten the 10% gain in the S&P 500. "We aim to be consistently good, not occasionally great," says Damore. The ETF charges 0.56% in expenses. Now, back on page 29, there was a nice little gray box. Mutual fund doubles. Have we met? Your name sounds familiar. It isn't unusual these days to find an exchange-traded fund version of a standout active mutual fund strategy. In fact, two members of the Kiplinger 25, the list of our favorite active mutual funds, Fidelity Blue Chip Growth and T. Rowe Price Dividend Growth, are also available as ETFs, run by the same skilled managers. But the ETFs aren't exact clones of the mutual funds. They can't be, in part because the mutual funds have greater latitude to invest in certain securities than the ETFs, such as stakes in companies that haven't gone public yet. For example, Fidelity's Sonu Kalra, who runs the Blue Chip Growth Mutual Fund and ETF, owns a stake in the private company Space Exploration Technologies, better known as Elon Musk's SpaceX, in the mutual fund, but not in the ETF. But ETF replicas are worth considering. The ETFs boast slightly lower expense ratios for a start compared with their mutual fund counterparts. Plus, there's no minimum to buy ETF shares at most brokerage firms. Side note, Fidelity has no minimum investment required for its mutual funds, but T. Rowe Price funds have a minimum initial investment of $2,500. Finally, the long-ish term returns are similar. Over the past 3 years, returns for the ETF and mutual fund versions of Fidelity Blue Chip Growth are the same, 9.7% annualized. We're carefully watching this trend of good active mutual funds opening ETF siblings. One new offering in particular has caught our eye: T. Rowe Price Capital Appreciation Equity. The ETF gives you access to the prowess of David Giroux, a star manager whose highly rated stock and bond mutual fund, T. Rowe Price Capital Appreciation, is closed to new investors. The ETF holds only stocks, almost 100 securities, which is more than the 40 to 60 names typically found in the balanced mutual fund, says a Price spokeswoman. But both leverage the fundamental bottom-up investment approach of the firm's extensive research team. And Giroux, of course. And there's another gray box on page 30. Less for Uncle Sam. A tax-friendly option. Tax efficiency has been a big draw for ETF investors. The advantage comes from the way ETF shares are created and redeemed. Mutual funds must sometimes sell underlying securities to meet shareholder redemptions. That can trigger a capital gains distribution, which is shared by all fund shareholders. Mutual funds are required by law to pay out any realized gains to shareholders at least once a year. ETFs, on the other hand, don't actually buy and sell the underlying securities in their portfolios. Instead, the ETFs hand over baskets of securities to third parties, institutional investors and market makers called authorized participants, for redemptions when shareholders in the fund sell shares, or the ETFs receive baskets of securities when shareholders buy shares and new shares must be created. No cash changes hands between the ETF and the authorized participants during these so-called in-kind transactions. And because of that, the ETF isn't as likely as a mutual fund to make a capital gains distribution. You're still liable for capital gains taxes when you sell shares, of course, though. According to an October 2023 study by T. Rowe Price, 47% of mutual funds, on average, distributed capital gains to their shareholders during the five-year period from the start of 2018 through 2022. By contrast, only an average of 7% of ETFs distributed gains. Next, on page 32, we have, "Are stocks in a bubble? Here's how to spot one, and how to tell when it pops." Article by Nellie S. Huang. The meteoric rise of a handful of tech stocks has many investors wondering whether the stock market is in a bubble. Bubbles have been the bane of investors since tulips took off in the 1600s, and they rarely end well. Obvious in retrospect, bubbles are notoriously difficult to recognize when you're in one. Here's what we do know. The so-called Magnificent Seven, Alphabet, Amazon.com, Apple, Meta Platforms, Microsoft, Nvidia, and Tesla, led the S&P 500 charge upward in 2023. And so far in 2024, the broad benchmark's gains have been ferocious. But some of the Magnificent Seven are already taking a breather, or perhaps even deflating. Tesla shares have lost 29% since the start of 2024. Apple stock has struggled too. "I think the bubble is already fading," says Francois Trahan, an economist and president of the Macro Institute, who says he was hesitant to use the term bubble until recently. A long history. There's an asset bubble almost every decade. In addition to the 1630s Dutch tulip bulb craze, notable examples include the Nifty 50, a group of blue-chip companies in the late 1960s, Japanese assets, real estate stocks, in the late 1980s, and, of course, the dot-com boom in the late 1990s. Most are driven by the arrival of a life-changing technology. The computer, the internet, artificial intelligence, or the belief that there's a permanent scarcity of goods. Bubbles usually follow a period of easy money, much like we've seen in recent years, says Trahan, which leads to a rebounding economy and a feeling of prosperity. That's usually when speculation kicks in. I'd say we have followed this historical pattern very well so far. Past market bubbles have shared three key traits as they neared extremes. First, there's a sizable gap between the price of the asset that's bubbling up and its fundamental value. Second, the buying frenzy expands to include everyone. Your mail carrier, say, or your mother. And third, there is rampant speculation, often amplified by trading with borrowed funds, as with margin accounts. But the biggest common denominator of all bubbles is greed, and the prevailing belief that soaring prices are justified because this time things are different, says Tron. You can believe that AI is real and it's going to change the world, the same way that the internet changed the world, but that doesn't mean that Nvidia stock is going to go up forever. Before a bubble pops, price volatility rises substantially as assets trade more on momentum and less on fundamental measures. That's when the bubble enters its greater fool stage, with buyers pushing prices to even more extreme levels because they believe a new buyer will pay an even higher price. The party typically ends after central banks raise interest rates, but the decline doesn't happen immediately. For instance, the Federal Reserve began raising rates in June 1999, but the dot-com bubble didn't peak and pop until early March 2000. Higher rates burst the bubble in Japan, too. The first interest rate hike came in March 1989. In December of that year, the Nikkei 225 peaked and the bubble popped. And the Nifty 50 bubble met its end when the Fed aggressively raised rates between January 1973 and April 1974. There are usually ample signs that an investment craze is overheating. Price-earnings ratios based on expected earnings rise to unsustainably high levels. The S&P 500's P/E, currently 22, is 29% above its long-term average. That's a concern, says Sam Stovall, chief investment strategist at CFRA Research, but it's nowhere near the benchmark's P/E of 27 in late 1999, just before the dot-com bubble peaked. Declining earnings estimates are another warning signal, says Stovall. Watch for less than encouraging company guidance for future quarters. If we can hear optimism from company managers regarding future growth, and we see numbers coming in better than expected, that would be a sign that the good times will continue, says Stovall. But when the talk turns less confident, It might be time to leave the party. Did you hear a pop? When a bubble deflates, it's often unclear whether the market is experiencing a pullback, a 5% to 9.9% decline, a correction, a 10% to 19.9% drop, or the start of a bear market, a decline of 20% or more, says Stovall. Some investors view early declines as buying opportunities, only to see prices to fall further. Confusion persists until everything starts dropping in price, and then it often feels as if there's no place to hide. The stocks that have been the high flyers suffer the most, of course. Defensive areas of the market tend to hold up better. In calendar year 2000, for instance, the year the dot-com bubble burst, the S&P 500 lost 9%, but top-performing sectors included healthcare, up 37%, utilities, up 57%, financials, up 25%, and consumer staples, up 17%. When the going gets tough, the tough go eating, drinking, and smoking. And when they overdo it, they go to the doctor, quips Stovall. Bonds tend to do well, too. Money will flock to bonds, or even bond-like stocks, such as utilities, after a bubble pops, says Tran. That's usually the place to be. In 2000, as U.S. stocks cratered, the Bloomberg U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, a high-quality benchmark of U.S. corporate and government debt, gained 11.6%. It would go on to deliver a 6.3% annualized return over the next decade. Some burst bubbles have led to long stretches of poor performance, known as lost decades, during which stock markets stagnate and economic growth slows. After the 1929 stock market crash, for instance, a drought in market returns lasted through 1939. Japan experienced several decades of slow economic growth and negative stock returns after the Nikkei 225 peaked in 1989. The index only this year recovered its 1989 peak level. And for the 10-year period after the dot-com bubble deflated, the S&P 500 lost 1% on average per year. So where are we now? Is it time to cut and run? Or should we continue to invest in this rally? Savita Subramanian, head of U.S. equity strategy at Bank of America Global Research, remains optimistic. The S&P 500 lacks signs of a bubble, she says. In our view, this bull market still has legs. But Stovall, who is bullish for the long term, nonetheless sees tiny bubbles that are beginning to concern him. The S&P 500 recovered all of its bear market losses on January 19th, he notes, and since then, stocks in companies of all sizes, styles, and sectors are in positive territory. This rising tide has most assuredly lifted almost all boats, says Stovall, adding, we're due for a pullback. The best defense. This is a good time to remind yourself of time-honored investing tenets, such as diversification. Lisa Chalet, Chief Investment Officer for Morgan Stanley Wealth Management, suggests diversifying your portfolio now with exposure to U.S. bonds and non-U.S. equities. Consider an equal-weighted S&P 500 index fund, which holds all of the stocks in the benchmark in equal proportion, so you're not so overweight with high flyers. Or explore assets that zig when stocks zag, such as hedge funds or alternative assets. Going to page 39, we have Dividends Are on the Way Back. Income Investing by Jeffrey R. Costnett. Savers and investors have few causes for complaint, but one frustration is the sluggish pace and shrunken heft of dividend increases. Although U.S. companies have more than $2 trillion in cash, scads of firms have not long ago raised dividends by 10% a year have morphed into relative misers. The median annualized increase within the S&P 500 dwindled to 6% in the fourth quarter of 2023. Look at ProShares S&P 500 Dividend Aristocrats, symbol NOBL, an equal-weighted exchange-traded fund of 68 stocks with 25 consecutive years or more of raises. From 2015 to 2020, the fund hiked its payout by 11.5% a year. Since the start of 2021, That fell to 5.4%, limited by near freezes from one-time cash spigots like Kimberly Clark. Apple is not an aristocrat, but clings to a habit of raising quarterly dividends each year by just a penny a share. UPS, soon to join the aristocrats, also just hiked its payout by 1 cent a quarter. I asked around and got explanations. Or excuses. One is that cash is so valuable, with interest rates up, that companies are hoarding it. Another is that a large cohort of CEOs expected a recession and refused to commit to high dividends that would be impossible to freeze or cut without an uproar. And there is the ever-present fixation with buybacks, despite a new 1% federal tax and the sky-high valuations of so many shares. Hence, the payout ratio, the percentage of earnings paid as cash dividends, has held at around 30% since the pandemic. It was 43% as recently as 2015 and 2016, and above 50% for much of the past 50 years. Signs of a comeback. As rates fall and cash yields eventually drop, tax-qualified dividend income will become relatively more valuable. Investors will press companies to pay up. Meta Platforms, formerly Facebook, chipped some ice with a first-time 50-cent quarterly dividend this year. Hardly a gusher, as Meta is handing out just $5 billion a year from its $45 billion of free cash flow. Salesforce followed with a similar initial cash payout. More encouraging, unexpectedly large early 2024 raises by old-timers such as Acker Daniels Midland, 11.1%, and Sherwin-Williams, 18.2%, as well as 25% from Exelon's power generation spin-off, Constellation Energy. John Deere has been raising dividends twice a year, its latest pair of hikes totaling 17.6%. Walmart stepped up with a 9.5% raise. S&P Dow Jones indices report more increases and fewer cuts so far in 2024 than in the same months of 2023, though overall payouts are still creeping rather than leaping. For a longer-term view, I consulted Dan Paris, who manages the Federated Hermes Strategic Value Dividend Fund, and is to dividend literature what the late John Le Carré was to spy novels. In a new book, The Ownership Dividend, The Coming Paradigm Shift in the U.S. Stock Market, Paris predicts that higher payout ratios are inevitable. His target is 50%, and insists the bloom is off, the buyback rose. Competition from higher fixed income yields will encourage fatter dividends. But Paris also says that company bosses are revisiting the idea that shareholders should be partners in the business rather than adversarial share sellers, and plying them with hard cash is central to this plan. Meta's payout, he says, is a green shoot and symbolic. With a yield of 0.4%, Meta is not an income investment, and may never be, but its move clears the way for other new generation firms that are serious about growth, but also aspire to average or above average dividend yields. That would be a breakthrough. And that's going to be it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading the June edition of Kiplinger Personal Finance. I'm Michael Prinz. So long, until next time.